Live from the heart of Los Angeles, this is the online edition of the Life Changes Show.
Look at the bright lights. Look at the bright
with tonight's guest, we'll author, space philosopher, and president of the Human Space Program, Frank
look
White.
Look at the night sky. Look at the night sky.
And performance guest, Paul Henning. I am Mark Leisure, and now our host, the MC, the master of change, Filippo Voltazio.
I was looking forward to an experience that I was going to be having. I knew it was coming up, and I couldn't wait for the experience. And as the experience got closer, I was starting to research and learn about the work that our guest tonight, Frank White, had done, and a particular phrase that he coined. And all of a sudden, when the experience happened, because of what I had learned, I think I was able to take it to a whole other level. So what am I talking about? This past couple days, my niece Fiorella was graduating from one of the largest universities in the country, and that was the experience I was looking forward to having, is sitting in the stadium and watching her graduate. Now, since I mentioned it, I might as well say that the experience just got more and more exciting because my niece ended up graduating at the top of her class with a grade average of 4.0. Congratulations to her. She received a Moore Award and she received many distinctions, and then during the graduation was asked by herself to stand and be recognized for her distinctions and all the awards and all that she had achieved throughout her academic studies and extracurricular studies. And academically, her major was applied biology. And so, that's not to include her tutoring job, tutoring other students, et cetera, et cetera. And her champion equestrian team work as in extracurricular activities. So all of that was very exciting. And then to see her come up on the Jumbotron and oh my gosh. And so I thought of my dad, who's no longer with us, who is an immigrant to this country, and how proud he would be that all his children are graduates of universities and upper graduate degrees. And now his first niece, or his first grandchild. So that was an experience that had me in tears at times and emotional at times, and sitting next to her parents and the grandparents. And oh, and then I had, as I was sitting high up in the stadium overlooking the graduates and being together with thousands and thousands of people, I had potentially what could be described as an overview effect. And we'll talk more about it a little later, but in a different way. But I was feeling, wow, all of us here have a story, an experience, a sense of pride or a sense of honor to be here, or a sense of excitement. And some of us potentially have sad stories getting to here, or sad stories after here, or right here, right now. But whatever it is, we are all right here, right now, having an experience together that is really big. And it's so big, in fact, that the thought of that, I'm still been processing. And I'm going to be processing for a while. And I think this show is going to help me in like next level. And I can't wait to see where we go from here.
That's kind of like an overgrad effect.
Oh my gosh. That's funny.
We should all be so lucky to be able to experience that for members of friends and family. But the the community nature is what I felt in your sharing, you know, the connection and community as well as the achievement.
Indeed. And so the overview effect and the new Camelot is what this title of this episode is. It's episode 789 of the Life Changes Show, Online Edition. And our guest is space philosopher, president of the Human Space Program, and author of The Overview Effect, Space Exploration and Human Evolution, and many other books. Welcome Frank White to the Life Changes Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Filippo. I mean, that was such a moving introduction. I'm now having to process it. What a great experience you had. And as I was listening to your niece's accomplishments, I had a thought. Do you think she might apply to be an astronaut?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know.
I think NASA would love to have her.
Do you know anybody there?
Well, I do. I do have my contact.
Oh, my gosh. Of course. I'm kidding. and you know, so thank you for inspiring that. And so we'll get into what that is and what you started. The breadth of the opportunity here. And not only is this cool, but this is needed. And now's the time. So let's get right into it. You coined a phrase, and that phrase is bigger than all of us. As a matter of fact, it includes all of us. When did this happen, and what was the inspiration?
Well, it was an experience, and I think there's another way to communicate it, but I haven't found it yet. It's something a bit beyond coining the phrase, and I'm not correcting you on that because that's what I say is I coined the phrase. But in fact, the phrase came to me in the middle of an epiphany.
Mm.
It appeared, and the story goes like this. In the late 60s and early 70s, a visionary named Gerard K. O'Neill began to lay out an approach to humanity's really large-scale migration from the Earth, filling up the solar ecosystem, or solar system as we talk about it. And I had become engaged with his Space Studies Institute, and I was thinking constantly, what would it be like to live off of planet Earth permanently? And on a cross-country trip in 1984, as best I can pinpoint it, I was thinking about that. I was looking down at the Earth for several hours, obviously, and it just came to me, if I lived in outer space all the time, the Earth would just be in the sky, and I would just know it's a whole system. There are no borders or boundaries on it. We're all in this together. I would have an overview.
Mm.
I would experience the overview effect. That's how it started. Of course, there were no people living permanently in outer space in 1984, and there still aren't. And I got in touch with NASA, and I said, well, I've got to interview all the astronauts right away.
Mm.
I felt an urgency. I've got to get data to confirm my hypothesis. And the guy at the other end of the line had a sense of humor. He kind of chuckled, you know, and well, all the astronauts, they're pretty busy, Frank. If you come to Houston, I will introduce you to two active astronauts and you can interview them. That was a little disappointing because I felt like I needed more than two. And then he said, why don't you interview retired astronauts? We don't control them. And that was the key phrase, because for some reason I never thought of that. I figured NASA did control them forever, you know, and that's what got it going. I went to Houston. I interviewed two great astronauts, and then I networked my way to another 14. And the first edition of the book was published in 1987. And now I've probably interviewed directly about 50 people who've had this experience.
You suggested I go look at a video, and I did, and it was quite amazing. And I wish I would have written down some of the things that they were saying. So can you tell us some of the experiences from your perspective?
This is a video I want to recommend to everyone. It's called The Astronaut's Perspective. It was produced by NASA. It was a result of a much more recent trip to Houston where I interviewed 10 astronauts. Three were on the International Space Station at the time. And out of those three interviews, a number of other interviews were done by other people. And this documentary, which is half an hour, was nominated for an Emmy. And I can say, because I didn't produce it, I helped, but I didn't produce it. I can say, if you really want to understand the overview effect, just sitting on your couch at home, this is my recommendation because that particular documentary just captures everything that I believe is important about the overview effect. There are three basic takeaways that the astronauts talk about. They all have their own individual experience. They all talk about it differently, but most of them will talk about the fact that there are simply no borders or boundaries on the Earth. And they'll talk about how they knew that intellectually, but not experientially. And in this documentary, one of the astronauts said, "I was looking for the little pink and green pictures on the globe, and I was looking for Uganda. It's supposed to be there, and it's pink." And you know, it sounds absurd, but that is how we see the Earth if we've never been off the planet. And they realize it's just false. It's just not even close. So they see that there are no borders or boundaries, that everything is connected. And it's brought up again and again. I saw the connection. What happens in Europe affects Earth, affects the US. What happens in China affects Germany, and so on. So there's this shift from intellectual knowledge to experiential knowledge. Almost every astronaut is really struck by how thin the atmosphere is, and there is this feeling of fragility. There's a realization, wow, we've got this garden planet, and as I look beyond it, there's nothing there. There's nowhere else we can go and live without special equipment. And not so much that the Earth is fragile, but our civilization is. And then third, it's part of the connectivity story. We're all in this together. We see divisions. We see divisions of nations, ethnicities, and so on. But we are bound together by being on a planet that is a spaceship, really. And, you know, we're all in this together. And it's kind of like we don't act like we're on a spaceship. But if the astronauts on the International Space Station acted the way we do, there'd be no International Space Station.
Interesting. And they do come from different parts of the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's very tense, but there are Americans and Russians there, and they're doing their job. And their job is really, they're doing science mostly. And there are people from other countries as well. 15 countries were involved actually in building the ISS. It is a tremendous tribute to what humans can do when they work together.
So this is now, you say, becoming a movement, and I could see the potential here. What is the movement, and potentially we've just expanded it into graduations and sports arenas, right?
Right. Yeah, so the movement has a name. It's called Bringing the Overview Effect Down to Earth. And what we're committed to is we would like to see the shift in consciousness that astronauts experience. We'd like to see it happen on the surface of the Earth. It's hard to do because our direct experience of our reality on Earth is the same experience our ancestors had 1,000 years ago. The Earth is a stable platform, the heavens revolve above us, and so on. But it's not a stable platform. As I've said again and again, we are in space. We've always been in space. We will always be in space. Astronauts don't even really go into space. They leave the planet. But the point is, they see the situation very, very differently. We would like to bring that experience down to Earth. And we do support people being able to have a suborbital or orbital experience because they will get the full power of the overview effect from that, because for one thing, being weightless is a big part of it. However, we're also supporting virtual reality experiences because virtual reality can reproduce the overview effect when it's done well. So we're in favor of that. But you see, what I really want to emphasize is it's not just a space project, it's an Earth project, because Joe Allen was one of the first astronauts I interviewed. He was a shuttle astronaut who worked on Apollo. And he said something to the effect of, for all the arguments pro and con for going to the moon, nobody said we should do it to look back at the Earth. But that might have been the most important reason. So as you go out there and as you listen to that documentary or watch it, you can see that what people talked about wasn't going to the moon or going to Mars. They talked about the Earth. And so I also insist that since the overview effect gives us a real understanding of who we are and where we are in the universe, it should be a human right for every person to have the experience by whatever means. And I mean, you got a taste of it. Because you knew a little bit about it, I think you were able to identify it as being sort of a version of what the astronauts are talking about. But most people on the Earth don't know the terminology, and they might be having experiences that would qualify. The astronauts flew for 25 years before the experience had a name. So naming it is critical. But what we want to do is change this psychological individual experience to a sociological planetary experience. Because the way we're behaving on the Earth, you don't have to read my book to know our behavior is not supporting our planet or our civilization very well.
Well, I think there's more to that, but since you paused, there's so much of course.
There's a lot more, but I know we don't have infinite time. Warned you, I can talk forever on it.
Well, and we like that. And so you have written forever, actually. So what was one phrase has not only turned into a movement, but a book, or then the movement, whichever came first, and then two books, and now a trilogy. So tell us about the trilogy. And as we put in the title, the second book is The New Camelot. What's that?
Well, that also came from an epiphany. And for those who don't like to spend hours reading, it's the shortest of the three. And it's the most straightforward. I've been fascinated with the stories of King Arthur and his knights almost as long as I've been fascinated with space exploration. And I was watching a film called Excalibur, which I think is the best King Arthur film ever made. And it hit me. I'd watched that film many times. It just hit me. Okay. So according to that film, Arthur's Holy Grail was not the cup that Jesus drank from at the Last Supper. His Holy Grail was unity of Britain, bringing together all of these little fiefdoms into one nation. And the Knights of the Round Table were like the Apollo astronauts, or the Apollo astronauts were like the Knights of the I don't know what he did to get there, but President Kennedy saw far beyond the situation he was in. And this book is also about a little known fact, which was he did not want a space race. He did not want to race to the moon. He approached Nikita Khrushchev early in his presidency and said, why don't we do a joint mission?
Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And then he actually, before the United Nations, he said, we should have a joint mission. And in fact, why don't we make it a multinational mission?
Mm.
Now imagine 1963. So I think he knew what the overview effect was, even though, I mean, really, it was so early in the program. How could he know? Maybe he could see the future. I don't. I mean, but it's an easy read, and it's about something that most people have a little bit of knowledge of. And then the third book is my effort to create a new space philosophy. And I've been honest with everybody about this. I was not trained to be a philosopher, and I don't call myself a philosopher. I call myself a space philosopher. Because shortly after the Challenger accident, there was a program called This Week with David Brinkley, and he had Isaac Asimov on, and he also had Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Right Stuff, and a guy named George Will, who was a famous or well-known commentator. And George Will was struck by the fact that we had just lost these astronauts on the Challenger. And it was kind of like, you know, haven't we been giving rather banal reasons for space exploration, like nonstick frying pans? And Tom Wolfe said, you're right. You're right. Our nation has never had a space philosophy or philosophy of space. And I've never felt comfortable being confined to one category. So even though I had no reason to be a philosopher of any kind, I looked around, I said, nobody is creating a space philosophy. So I'm going to have to do it. And so finally I got around to the Cosma hypothesis, and that starts out asking the question, why, after billions of years of evolution, do we have a species called humanity or Homo sapiens that actually has the capability to leave the planet. And I realized all of the reasons we give for going and leaving the planet are self-serving. We don't ask the question, how will this help the Earth? How will this help the universe? And so I believe, and some of my colleagues believe, that I call the universe Cosma, just to give it a name. And I believe Cosma has brought this species to this point to bring life, intelligence, and self-awareness out into the universe. In other words, the universe is becoming more alive, more intelligent, and more conscious through humanity. And that's why we have been brought to this point. And I went back and looked at all my astronaut interviews, and I found that a lot of them were talking about a different understanding of the universe, and I had just missed it because I was focused on the Earth in the first two books. So that's the trilogy. And, you know, each book has its own particular flavor and value, I think.
We weren't going to talk about this, but since we're talking about books, and I said you've authored many, are artificial intelligence, the neo singularity is here. Do you mind giving us a 1 minute spiel on that? Because that's a big topic too. There were so many topics, it was hard to choose, Frank.
No. Yeah. Well, if there's another area of exploration that fascinates me as much as space exploration, it's artificial intelligence. And I've been fascinated with that for a long, long time. I've been fascinated with computers for a long, long time. But again, my interest is the impact of space exploration on humanity, and my interest in AI is the same.
Interesting
enough, you bring up my book, and I think it's a pretty darn good book, if I may say so. But it was published, I believe, in 2018 or somewhere in there. And it's really out of date. Here's the basic thesis of it. The singularity has been talked about for many years. And it's that point at which artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence. And for a long time, people interested in it thought it would be many, many years in the future that that we would have what we now call artificial general intelligence. And then after that, artificial superintelligence. So I think what I pointed out in the book was much of what we're afraid of, which is AI essentially controlling the world. What I was talking about then was, isn't the internet essentially what we're afraid of? There are little nodes of AI everywhere on the planet. And this was before ChatGPT. And those little nodes of AI are already influencing us and beginning to shape us. And I called it the neo singularity. And, thing that I didn't foresee, and I don't think anybody saw it, was ChatGPT being released on the world with very little advance warning, and then all of a sudden it just became deeply embedded in society. And it also set off kind of a race among these brilliant people at these different companies to now. They used to talk about artificial general intelligence as way in the future, but now they're saying we're actually out to create AGI. And so,
well,
yeah, I think I don't call it artificial intelligence. I call it another intelligence because I think that's what it is. And I recently saw one of the leaders of the AI movement call it a digital species. That's,
Wow.
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's artificial, but it's, I don't, again, I don't like that term, artificial. I call it another intelligence. He calls it a digital species. I believe we're saying the same thing. I also believe we have to decide, are we going to look at AI as a slave, a partner, or a ruler? We don't seem to know which we want. And of course, it's going to affect space exploration too. It can be a partner. I suppose if we have a super intelligence, it could decide that humanity should just stay on the Earth. I think it's wrong morally to think of it as a slave. So I think a lot of the concern we're seeing about AI is, first of all, it was not expected or predicted by anyone that I know. But secondly, we don't quite know how we want to deal with it. We haven't decided yet.
There are a lot of things we haven't decided, a lot of things we don't know, and it feels like you have, like we've teased so many of these topics together. One that we didn't get to tease is the human space program,
Right.
and that question of whether humans should be on the planet and or elsewhere, which is fascinating and a whole other subject. I have to thank Allison Goldwyn, our contributing producer at Synchronistory, for saying you have to have Frank White on the show. Whatever he ends up talking about on the show will be fascinating. And it has been, and it's just been an overview. Or I shouldn't say just been an overview, because sounds like the overview is a really big thing. And thank you for bringing it to where it is now, and may it grow. I want to share your website real quick, Frank White, just as it sounds, author.com, and then of course humanspaceprogram.org, just as that sounds. And Frank, of all the things that we could say at this moment, as we're bringing our talk this time around at least to a close, anything you'd like to add as parting words for now?
I would like to just suggest to people that you, when you look at topics like space exploration and artificial intelligence, you're not helpless. You can have a very big impact on the future because decisions are being made right now about these two topics and others that are going to shape our children and our grandchildren's futures. And if you have an idea, please find a way to get involved because I did not have any credentials whatsoever to write The Overview Effect. And I just had an experience that I couldn't shake.
Wait, says the man that was magna cum laude himself, a graduate of Harvard College and member of Phi Beta Kappa and a Rhodes Scholar. But anyway, go on.
Well, all of that didn't really qualify me in the eyes of the world in 1984 to write a book.
Okay.
So, I mean, it
No,
was outside
I understand.
my field, and you know, I didn't have a PhD. I wasn't an astronaut. My point is, I think everybody on the planet has a purpose. And I think the goal that each person has is to find their purpose. I can't tell you what it is. However, please don't think you can't have any impact because this is about humanity and our future. So you've got to be involved. One thing we often say in the movement is there are no passengers on Spaceship Earth, only crew.
Nice.
And that means, you know, you are the crew.
Yeah. Wow. Frank, thank you for this message and these messages here today. It's been a pleasure.
And thanks to Allison as well. And tell your niece to look into being an astronaut.
I will talk to her. Thank you, Frank. All right. And with a big thank you to Frank White, we now move on to our Ask Dorothy segment.
Dear Dorothy, this is Walter, and I will be 75 years young in a few months. Many of my family and friends want to have a big celebration for me because they believe that this is a big year in birthday time. Now, I may be having another birthday, but I don't want to be celebrating what others see as me reaching the beginning of old age. Many of my family and friends reached old age when they turned 50. I believe that being old is a state of mind, and although I have been around for 75 years, I feel I have so many wonderful years ahead of me. How do I say no to a party?
Dear Walter, you are absolutely correct in knowing that age is a state of mind, and it is also a biological number. How we look at it and how we think about it is what matters most. Unfortunately, society has been programmed to believe that we will all reach old age after a certain number of birthdays. And for years, that number has been projected as 65. Forbes has an excellent article on how 75 is the new 65 in determining chronological age, and the article says this: a focus on chronological age would be fine if its relationship with biological age were constant, but sustained improvements in life expectancy mean this isn't the case. Walter, there's also a great study on reversing aging at businessinsider.com that might change the way you look at aging. If you'd like to check it out, please write me at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com, and I will be happy to send you the article, as it is fascinating. I'm very happy for you, knowing that even though you have been around for some time now, that you do not see yourself as old. I don't believe you have to say no to a party that is given to celebrate your birth. So let's convince the party givers that it would be wonderful to celebrate your amazing life and not make the number of years the important part of the celebration. And you can entertain the guests by sharing all of the awesome and exciting plans you have for the many years to come. Congratulations on celebrating life instead of numbers.
Thank you, Dorothy. And if any of you have a question for Dorothy, please write her before your next birthday at askdorothy@lifechangesshow.com.
And we'll be right back with our performance guest, Paul Henning, here on the Life Changes Show Online Edition right after this.
The Little Dog That Could is the fantastically true story of a man and a little dog that came into his life as his mentor to help him understand the world beyond his human senses and to experience life, love, and healing beyond his human understanding. Best-selling author Filippo Voltaggio, who currently hosts the highly regarded Life Changes show, is an internationally known singer, speaker, and life coach. Filippo offers up his own story, how one little surprise package in fur and four legs transformed his life unexpectedly forever and furthered his path of self-discovery. In The Little Dog That Could, Filippo brings to life the meaning of the adage, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Through the reading of this book, you will experience the journey of real miracles that transcend time, space, and logic while gaining practical tools that will help you navigate your way. The Little Dog That Could is available through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. For more information, visit thelittledogthatcould.com. That's thelittledogthatcould.com.
There are self-help seminars costing thousands of dollars guaranteeing miraculous transformations. There are compelling speakers and life-changing weekend experiences where you can walk on fire. They all deliver revelations that guarantee you'll come back for the more expensive revelations filled with even greater wonder next month on Fiji. We get addicted to positive, heartfelt, expensive theater. What we really need is a jumpstart, an awakening. Someone who can give us a reminder that everything we need lies within. Through inspiration and practical knowledge, Dorothy Donahue helps people get grounded and motivated, inspired and energized. It's not just words and affirmations and the power of intention. It's a mindset brought about by a tangible, transcendental experience, an audio-visual, physical, spiritual experience that helps us realize we transform ourselves. We get tools to become the conscious co-creators of lives of unlimited potential. Find out more. Go to DorothyDonahue.com.
You are listening to A Conversation That Matters on The Life Changes Show, broadcasting live from the heart of Los Angeles every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Share the journey with us at lifechangesshow.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Life Changes Show.
We are back, and our performance guest is a film and TV composer, a multi-instrumentalist, and so much more. We'll talk about that in a moment. Welcome, Paul Henning, to the Life Changes Show.
Thanks, Filippo. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. And I have to laugh. So first off, I want to thank Marina Manoukian of the Enlightenment Music Series, where I think we might have met already. She suggested that I look at your work, and we, as soon as all of us saw your work, we were sold right away. But she introduced you as a violinist, and then we heard your work, and I was looking for the violinist, but you were the pianist and the composer and the arranger, and so then I called Marina. I said, I'm confused. And she says, oh, Filippo, he plays piano, he plays violin, he plays harp, he plays flute. He arranges, he composes. Okay. There it is. Paul Henning.
Yes. Yes. All those things. And Marina is a wonderful violinist and colleague in the studios here in Los Angeles. I was sitting with her on a new film recording, and we got to talking about your show, and it worked out. So I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you here, and looking forward to featuring your music. And another funny thing is, in a sense, I was looking for, like, how did you get started in music? And you said, well, you grew up on a farm. And I thought, okay, this is going to be good. Let's make the connection.
Yeah, so I grew up on a farm in Eastern Washington State, and it's a very old farm. It's 135 years old. It's been in my family that entire time. And so I had a grandmother that lived on the farm there, and she had an organ in her house. All of us kids would mess around in it. She noticed I was able to put together melodies or imitate her on the Christmas carols, and she suggested to my mom that I should start piano lessons, and I did. So that's how I started in music, was on the farm.
Did you do other things on the farm too?
I did. I spent weekends on the farm, and I drove a wheat truck during harvest when I was in high school. So I was involved, but really my cousin and uncle and dad ran the farm out there.
Wow. 135-year-old farm in the family. That's interesting. And so you started with organ, in a sense, and then from organ to piano, and then so piano is your first, and then violin?
Yeah, violin, flute, and then harp is very recent. I only started just before the pandemic, but I am performing in some orchestras already as a harpist too. So most of my work is as a violinist professionally in film recording sessions, TV scores, album recordings, all the stuff that Marina plays on too, and other studio violinists, and also live orchestras. I'm concertmaster, which is first chair, first violin of two orchestras in LA, and then sub and play in other professional orchestras as a violinist as well.
So basically you're a musical genius.
I'm not gonna say that, no. I practice three instruments every night. It takes a lot of time to do all of this, and also find time to arrange and orchestrate and all these things, so.
Well, because harp is a fairly new instrument. You picked it up it sounds like 3 or 4 years ago, maybe five, and from what you're saying, and then you're already playing in orchestras with the harp.
Yeah, I started just before the pandemic, and so I was taking lessons for a few weeks, and then the lockdowns happened, and I kept taking lessons the entire way through on Zoom with my teacher, who's a studio harpist in LA on so many movies, and I just kept going the whole way through there, had tons of time to practice, and I had no idea where I'd go with it, but yeah, I've played about 6 or 7 concerts now as a harpist with orchestras, getting more experience. I have 2 more coming up. So,
wow. Well, we're going to get to hear a portion of one of your pieces. The album is Breaking Through, and this is the actual title piece from it. Anything you want to say about the piece that we're going to hear, or at least the piece of the piece?
Yeah, this is the first track of 8 that I wrote for an original album of my music that is for piano, which I performed, and also a chamber orchestra, about 40-something players. We recorded it at Capitol Records. I had a friend help contract it and put it together. And the music is, in a sense, a little Americana. It features piano, but piano's not always the soloist. Other instruments are piano. It might be a horn or a flute or horns, woodwinds, trumpets that take turns. This was the first of the 8 pieces that I started with, and the title piece.
And because I also found this interesting, I just want you to elaborate on the fact that it started as a melody, a simple melody, and then you took that melody and put it upside down and length. It did all kinds of things with it.
Yes, those are pretty basic compositional tactics or techniques to take a simple phrase, whether it be a theme or a melody, and then you make it faster, longer and slower, upside down, backwards, all these different variations to see if anything else interesting that comes out of it. And it will all sound related, even if it's upside down and backwards and whatever else. And sometimes you can make them work together. So I started with one little simple motif and then expanded it out from there.
Well, we're going to hear it now. This is a pre-recorded version, and it is Paul Henning's Breaking Through on the Life Changes Online Edition.
Thank you.
Paul Henning and Breaking Through. Paul, especially after listening to our guest Frank White, I think I was visualizing like a spaceship taking off and seeing the Earth and the momentum building, and oh, it worked perfectly for me. Thank you.
It does tie together. And my dad actually worked for Lockheed Martin in the 60s when they were developing some of the stealth technology and other things like that. So
wow,
a little bit of tie together there too.
How interesting. Well, Paul Henning at Henning, paulhenning.com is his website. We have other links to Paul's socials, etc., at lifechangesshow.com. Where you will find Paul Henning's page, a video there as well, and much more information about him. But of course, his music is available where music is available. The album is by the same name, Breaking Through, and we're going to get to hear another track. I wish we could have played that whole track because it builds and it takes you there, wherever you think you're going. And actually, speaking of taking you there, I found it interesting how you have visited so many places and how those places somehow find themselves in your music. Could you describe that experience for us, please?
So my whole family and the farm is, of course, in the Pacific Northwest, and I live in Los Angeles. I have been living here for the last 24 years. So I've driven up to Washington State, I don't even know how many dozens of times, back and forth. And every time I take a different route, I've been all the way up the coast, up 395, up through Nevada, up through all these different roads. And I've taken a lot of photos of all the different places I've visited, all the parks I've stopped at on these trips. And I've incorporated some of the feel of some of these small towns and desert landscapes and Western Americana into my music. Some of the tracks that are on the album that we're not playing today especially feature a more Americana feel, a little bit more folk music incorporated into the melodies. But yeah, I definitely envision these landscapes that I've taken in through the years in the music when I write it and try to capture it.
And in this piece that we're going to hear today, before we say that, I should mention how you have played for and with many artists that people would recognize: Andrea Bocelli, Aretha Franklin, Josh Groban, Michael Bublé, etc. Oh, Barbra Streisand too. And did recorded for movies and et cetera, I mean, we have his bio at lifechangesshow.com, as I mentioned, Paul Henning. But does that play into... do those experiences play into the music as well?
I would say they certainly built on it. And a violinist friend of mine, Mark Robertson, who works as a studio violinist, helped me put the orchestra together, which we recorded at Capitol Records here in LA. The whole album was done there. I played the piano in Studio A, which is a legendary room. And of course, I'd played there many times in that room as a violinist on other people's soundtracks and albums. But I really felt like I wanted to record in that room. It's so legendary. And when you enter through the hallway to go into Studio A, when you're recording there, that's just lined with these black and white photos of everyone who's recorded there through the years. They're incredible. You see Frank Sinatra and all of these people on the walls in these black and white photos. It's really something to walk into that studio. And I'm glad I got to do it there.
And you just before we hear the song, you kind of put that vibe not only into the marketing, but your pictures and the way they're taken, the coloring that's used, or the black and white or sepia, like you're committed to this feel. And you described it, do you remember how you described it while we were talking to me?
The black and white feel, in the photos that I had a photographer come and take some pictures at the very start of my piano sessions at Capitol. And I was just wearing a white shirt and a black tie, and he did them in black and white. And I think they look very timeless that way, you know, like you're part of this continuum of of albums and of music that's been recorded in a very sacred space for recording in Los Angeles. Almost all of us as studio musicians have recorded in that room before, and other big rooms in town, Warner Brothers, Sony, or former MGM, and of course Fox. But that room is very special, very intimate, and has a soft wooden feel about it. And so I wanted to capture some of that in the photos, which I believe there's some on the website.
So interestingly enough, the song that we're going to hear now, or the piece, is Days Gone By. But in describing that piece, you said something that really hit, quote unquote, home for me. Do you remember what that was?
I'm thinking you might be thinking of some of the tunes in this. I've taken sort of my idea of various folk tunes, and some are from my heritage, my mom's side from Ireland, and maybe some are from the US or America. And I've sort of combined them and made my own version of it and set it in my own setting. And I wanted to capture what one might think of as their home or their roots, where they came from, where their family and ancestors came from, into a very simple melody. And I hope I've done that. Is that what you were referring to?
Exactly. Okay. Right. And I think people will hear it and appreciate it. And again, this is only a short clip of the piece. Not so short, but the piece does go on beautifully. But this is the part we're going to get to hear here on the Life Changes show. Here is Paul Henning's Days Gone By.
Thank you.
Paul Henning with Days Gone By. Indeed. Paul, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad I got to do it.
You know, you painted such a beautiful picture before and then during the piece. I wish we could have played it all. I have to say that as a singer, I'm hearing some vocals coming on. So I'm just throwing it out there since you know the composer.
I do know the composer. Unfortunately, the composer is not a lyricist, but you probably know some people who could help.
We'll have to talk. In the meantime, we certainly enjoy it as it is. It does stand alone. Thank you so much. Wow. All the best to you. I'm looking forward to now hearing the rest of the album and to seeing you perform with one of the orchestras in town. So go to Paul Henning, HENNING.com. To learn more about him and his music is available on Apple Music and where music is available. And you can find him on his socials. Facebook, for example, is Paul Henning Music. Go to lifechangesshow.com and look up Paul Henning and you'll see a video of one of his pieces and learn more about him there as well. Paul, what a pleasure to connect with you.
Same, likewise.
With a thank you to our performance guest, Paul Henning, and another thank you to our interview guest, Frank White. That is our show. On behalf of our executive producer, Dorothy Lee Donahue, and our executive producer and co-host, Mark LeJure, I am your host, Filippo Voltaggio, reminding you that as your life changes, or shall I say, as your overview changes, we're here for you. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to the Life Changes Show on the BBS Radio Network. Listen live every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Time and visit us online at lifechangesnetwork.com, on Facebook at the Life Changes Show, and on Twitter at Life Changes Show. Join us again next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes. The Life Changes Network is an entertainment network. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and participants and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Life Changes.